Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's joint meeting of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bruce Pickering, Program Director of the World Affairs Council. On behalf of both organizations, we also extend a special welcome to listeners of radio station KSKS in Fresno, California, one of more than 225 stations nationwide carrying the Commonwealth Club programs. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the podium over to Helen Grieco, State President of the National Organization for Women, who will introduce today's speaker.
Thank you and welcome, everyone. On behalf of the National Organization for Women and our members and women around the globe who care about justice and freedom, we wanted to say thank you to Mavis Nicholson Leno for her courage, for taking a stand on this, and for tirelessly working to educate people around the country and around the globe about this issue. The National Organization for Women and the Feminist Majority are sister organizations, and now, in specific California now, also signed on to the brief here to try to stop UNICAL from doing business and putting the pipeline in a country that would treat women so despicably. So we're grateful to work together as sister organizations, and it's very important that, Mavis, that you're doing this work, and we can't thank you enough, because when you see the information, your heart just breaks, you get so angry, and we have to remember that if they can do it to those women, they can do it to us, and we have to stop this. But I have to tell you that I've wanted to meet you for a number of years, and it's kind of a funny story. Actually, it's your spouse, Jay, that kind of tuned me into you. After a long day of activism, you come home and you just want to have a laugh because these are hard jobs. And I get home at 11 or 11:30 and I catch a little news and you do the late night thing. And of course, I'd love to have a woman be on late night, but I'm Italian American, so we know where my allegiance lies. Jay looks a lot like my dad and my brother, actually, so it's kind of fun. And one night he makes the statement that he was at a feminist bookstore with his wife. And I just lit up. I was like, Mavis is a feminist. Cool. And then a little bit after that, a friend of mine wound up going to lunch with you, and I told her, Mavis is a feminist. And she goes, Mavis rocks. You know, she's great. So I thought that was really great. And then I learned that you were working with the Feminist Majority, and on the 209 campaign, I was the press director in Northern California. You were doing your work. Then this issue came up, and you stepped up to the plate again, and I'm doing a wonderful job. So I had written this poster, How to Be a Fabulous Feminist. So I wanted to officially induct you today into the Fabulous Feminist Club and give you a tote bag for fabulous feminists who travel around the globe doing the good work. So we really appreciate. And once again, on behalf of NOW and all the women and the feminist majority and the organizations and the people that care about justice for women, what you're doing is so important, and you are the experts, so please educate us. We welcome you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming today. Everybody recently has said, oh, you have so much courage to do this. This is so funny to me because you cannot imagine the courage of the Afghan women that I have met in the course of pursuing this. My perception of myself is that I was born in paradise and upgraded to heaven. It's the least I can do is pay some attention to people who didn't win the lottery. And these women sure as hell didn't win the lottery. Back in college when I was taking art appreciation, I remember learning that during the Middle Ages, there was a repellent religious theme that was often depicted in paintings of those times. Hieronymus Bosch was particularly fond of this theme. People would be going down a thoroughfare. There would be rich people, poor people, tradesmen selling their goods, wealthy people off to a party in their finery, poor people in the streets begging, everybody going about their business on an ordinary day in their lives. That would be the first panel. Second panel, the ground would suddenly open with no warning, gape open, and all of these people would be swallowed into the fires of hell. And particularly, again, in the Bosch paintings, you'd see like little tiny people plummeting into the mouths of grotesque beasts and, you know, limbs being severed from people, et cetera, et cetera. violence didn't originate with American films. So the worst part of these paintings to me and the theme that they depicted was not actually shown in the paintings. After these people fell into the gaping jaws of hell with no warning, in the middle of their lives, the earth would close and they would be forgotten. No one would know what happened to them and they would be lost. To me, this is what happened to the women of Afghanistan. And when I heard what was going on there, fairly early in the situation, it was about 3 months old when I first learned that this had happened, I found myself, in my mind, in the same position as a person who happens to be walking by a lake when somebody's going down for the third time, and you know that you can swim. I couldn't know this and not do something about it. Let me give you a little history about the situation in Afghanistan. This country has been decimated by an extremely long 20-year-old civil war. It is, I believe, either the first or second most landmined country in the world. And since it is mainly an agrarian society, this is particularly hard because it's pretty difficult for people to farm countryside, which is thickly sown over with landmines. Most of the infrastructure of the country has been destroyed. There's great poverty. There's great hardship. And all of these things were true before the Taliban took over. Nevertheless, women were contributing members of that society at every level, as is true in almost every country in the world. In the urban areas, the women lived the most contemporary lives. Some of them wore Western dress, some more traditional dress, but it was entirely their choice, and they had had equal rights under the law since the 60s. They held down an enormous quantity of all the important positions in the government and in the professions. In the countryside, women did live more conservative lives, but they had a rich support system amongst the other women of their community. And although some of them did wear the burqa, the garment that all women now have to wear according to the Taliban edict if they leave their houses, they wore the burqa mainly for visits to the town. The burqa is a very expensive garment. One of the great hardships that has been visited upon women in Afghanistan since the Taliban took over falls heavily on the rural areas where women cannot afford a burqa. And therefore, as many as 12 or 14 women share in the use of one garment. And should you have an emergency, should your child fall ill, break a leg, you need to take this kid to the hospital or any available medical care right now. If it's not your turn for the burqa, too bad. One of the many Afghan women that I have come to know in the course of following this campaign told me that it is ridiculous to suggest that the women in rural areas wore the burqa as a common thing. Not only is it too expensive for most of them to have owned, but in most farming areas, women worked in the fields alongside their husbands, which you cannot do in a burqa. In fact, there is almost nothing you can do in a burqa. One of the singular qualities of this garment is that it renders you incapable of almost any independent action. It is the case under the Taliban edicts that you must go out of your house not only wearing the burqa but accompanied by a close male relative. But in truth, it would be very difficult for somebody to navigate and manage their tasks while wearing a burqa if they did not go out accompanied by someone. You have no peripheral vision in this garment. In fact, the only vision provided to you is through a approximately 2.5 by 2 inch square of mesh, which sits over your eyes. This is the mesh. The feminist majority has started wearing these, and we are sending them to people who are interested in taking action as a token of remembrance for the women in Afghanistan. This little 2.5 by 2 inch square of dense mesh, which is hard to see through, provides no peripheral vision and also does not allow for breathing. You breathe through the solid cloth of the burqa itself. It's the only view of the outside world that is left to these women anymore, since their windows have to be painted in an opaque color. They cannot look out of them. And if a woman rides in a car, all the windows except for the front window must also be either curtained or painted opaque. These are the kinds of egregious, excessive restrictions which have prompted us to call this gender apartheid. In reality, the people who suffered under apartheid in South Africa had less restriction by far than these women do. They can no longer work in any capacity, although if they have no other means of support, which is a serious issue in a country where so many men have been killed in war. Women far outnumber men in Afghanistan. So there are many widows. Many women are the sole support of their families. And now that they can no longer work, they are sometimes allowed to beg. But there is almost no other form of self-support left open to them, even though these women were once lawyers, doctors, professors, midwives, nurses, teachers. When we made the film that you just saw, we had to go to the Afghan American community to get enough pictures of how the women lived before the Taliban took over. We asked people to give us home movies, family photographs, anything that showed the good times that they had enjoyed prior to the takeover. Why did we have to do this? Because the Taliban insists that many of these situations never occurred. When I was discussing the theme of these medieval pictures, a popular idea promulgated by religious people of the time was that when Judgment Day occurred and all the people that were saved went to heaven and all the people that were damned went to hell and all the people that ever were and ever would be were judged and allotted to their proper place, in order that the people that were in heaven would not grieve and mourn for the people they loved who had instead been sent to hell, the religious people of that time said that when Judgment Day was over, hell would seal shut and no one would remember anyone who was condemned to go there. This desire to erase history has plagued people for a long time. It was a feature of the Nazis in the concentration camps that they would often tell the Jews that when the war was over and they had won, they would destroy the concentration camps. They would hide all the evidence of what had happened there, and they would tell the populace at large that the Jewish population had gone to live in other non-fascist countries so that no one would ever know what had happened to them. And many people that were interned in those camps have said that one of their main motives for surviving in such a terrible environment was that they were determined to live to tell their story and call the Nazis liars. These films that we got, these photographs from the Afghan-American community on a smaller scale, a less melodramatic scale, do the same thing. The Taliban would like to say that their country was always a conservative Islam culture, that women never enjoyed the freedoms that, in fact, they enjoyed. But that is not the case, and we are here to put the lie to it. The Taliban is essentially a tribal group. They are predominantly Pashtun. There are three major ethnic groups that live in Afghanistan: Pashtun, Tajik, and Hazara. The Hazara have always been subjected to a certain amount of prejudice. They have some Mongolian ancestry. And the Pashtun actually occupy not only Afghanistan, but a great deal of Pakistan. And when Pakistan was, the lines of demarcation were drawn to create the state of Pakistan, the Pashtun population was essentially divided in half between the two countries. So it is not so odd that Pakistan has helped to educate and promulgate the Taliban, and they recognize them as the legal government of Afghanistan. They are one of only three countries who do make that recognition, and they give them fiscal support. One of the things that the feminist majority would like the United States to do is to address this issue with Pakistan. Pakistan has a long, strong relationship with America. We give them money. We help them out. We have a lot of interaction with them. We need to say to them, you have to speak to these people. The fact is that there is no fabulous alternative government for Afghanistan at the moment. In other words, I can't say, oh, if only the Taliban weren't there, the such and such could take over. There is no really rich, wonderful, democratic alternative. And even if there were, that is none of my business. That's not America's business. I am strictly concerned with the human rights of the women and girls there. I do not want to displace the Taliban. I want them to understand how enormously wrong their treatment of women is to the rest of the world, and to moderate it. Give these women back the lives and the freedoms that they enjoyed before. Now, recently some people have been suggesting that the Taliban has in fact moderated. Well, they have yet to rescind their edicts, and it is from these edicts that we get the information that I have just given you about how the women are treated. In other words, this is not word of mouth from people who witnessed it. This is from the Taliban themselves. If they wish to be seen as moderating their position, they must rescind these edicts. They must allow observers into the country to confirm that they are, in fact, treating the women in a fair, humane, and equal way. And that's all we basically ask. We don't want any sort of revolution there. We simply want these people to listen to reason. There are a lot of things that everybody out here this evening can do to help this cause along. The Taliban does not have a lot of money. The country is destroyed. It will take a lot of money and a lot of effort to rebuild it. One of the things that gives me hope about moderation of the Taliban stance is that I see no possible way that the Taliban or any other government can rebuild this country while they keep better than half of their population under what essentially amounts to house arrest. One of the things that I believe has made the West so strong, so powerful, so successful is that we use all our human resources. Who knows how many ideas, how many inventions, how many innovations are lost to countries that will not give equal rights to the women, to certain racial groups, whatever these particular people decide is a group that should be singled out to have no opportunity in their society. Afghanistan needs every single citizen to rebuild the country. And it is my hope that the more moderate elements of the Taliban, which I am told exist, the people that I speak to from the Afghan community say, do not imagine that this is a monolithic group. They have lots of factions, some of whom are much more moderate. It happens that the extremists are in power now. It is my hope that the more moderate, more reasonable people will realize that not only will they never gain acceptance in the world community while they treat women like this, but they'll never fix their country unless they want to spend the rest of their natural lives walking up and down the streets of the country with shotguns and chains, hitting people because they're not conforming to some tiny minutia come up with by the Taliban themselves. They're not going to be able to reconstruct a society that will live on its own. I think that we need to increase immigration to this country from Afghanistan so that people who have fled or are able at some point in the future to leave can come to this country. You would imagine that we would be inundated by Afghan immigrants, but the reality is that when the feminist majority checked the statistics, to our astonishment, we found that thousands of Afghans were let into this country and welcomed during the war with the Soviets. But since the Taliban takeover 2.5 years ago, guess how many Afghan people have been admitted to this country? None. Zero. This is ridiculous. No one is a political refugee if these people aren't political refugees. And if you don't think that this is a human rights violation, then I don't know what you mean by human, or I don't know what you mean by rights. So that is the first step that we can take, pressuring the government to take this action. Then we can ask America to speak to the three nations in the Middle East who are alone in recognizing the Taliban as the legal government of Afghanistan and alone in giving them money. That would be Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and the United Arab Emirates. We have strong influence, particularly with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. We should use it. We should speak to them in the name of decency and in the name of reason and say, you know, this is your family. There's one in every family. You go talk to them. Tell them it won't fly. Another thing that we need to do is be concerned about United States companies setting up in Afghanistan and financing, not perhaps as a direct result of their business being set up there, but as an indirect result, financing the Taliban. If the Taliban had a lot of financial support, they would have no need to listen to the world community. They could take the ball and go home. We don't want that to happen. The problem is that they are by far the most viable country through which to run a gas pipeline, which would take a huge, huge gas deposit. Some people have suggested it is so large it might last as long as 500 years. A huge gas deposit from Turkmenistan, which has, of course, no coast, through Afghanistan to Pakistan, where it could be shipped around the world. It is this pipeline which brought me into direct contact with Unocal. I spoke out at a stockholders meeting that they had, and I participated in a number of actions to try and persuade them not to build a pipeline there and fund this terrible regime. Now, let me be very clear about this. Somebody's going to get this gas. I would like it to be the United States. We're a decent country. We're a humane country. We stand for human rights as much as anybody in the world. And the business of business is to make money. There's nothing wrong with wanting to put the pipeline through here. But you don't have to become a fiscal giant at the expense of being a moral dwarf. Go to the Taliban and say you can have hundreds of millions of dollars right now. Let the women out of their houses. Knock it off. Is that so hard? Is that such a big deal? I think a company could say that. And furthermore, the feminist majority has made it their business to look into what other countries might also want to put the gas pipeline through there. And some of you may be aware, and some of you not, that there are feminist organizations even in some very unlikely places, including almost all the Middle Eastern countries. We intend to speak to our sisters in Japan. Japan is trying to involve themselves with the Taliban on the basis of this pipeline. We intend to speak to our sisters in Great Britain, which also has an interest in putting a pipeline through there. In both of these countries, the gender gap in voting is similar to what it is in the United States. In other words, it behooves the government of both these countries, as it behooves the government of this country, to listen up when women say, "We're really bothered by this." Because you could find yourself out of office if you don't listen up. So we are going to speak to these women. We are going to make it our business that no one can do business in Afghanistan comfortably and with the sanction of their population, so that eventually the Taliban, which is a very young, most of them are under 25, very inexperienced group of people, we will make it clear to them that women are significant in the cultures of all the other countries in the world. They are a force to be reckoned with, and they do not want, and nor do men, who have mothers that they love and daughters that they have great hopes for, want the next 1,000 years to be like the last 1,000 years for women. The work that the feminist majority has done to try and help the women of Afghanistan is beginning to yield some results. And I think that if everybody joins on board, if we pressure the government each in our own way, this has no political agenda. We have some profound conservatives that are on board with us, as well as some renowned liberals. This is human rights. This is human decency. This has nothing to do with political attitudes whatsoever, except the political attitude that the world, if it cannot get better, should at least not get worse. I was privileged to make a tape for Voice of America, which they promised me they would take into Afghanistan itself, so that the women there would know that women in the rest of the world knew what had happened to them and were not going to rest until something was done. Because these women were like people buried in a mine cave, and they had no idea if somebody was searching for them. They had no idea if anybody even knew what happened to them. That's how fast and how overwhelming the takeover was. So anyway, I did a very short tape for Voice of America, and they taught me how to say Maba Shuma Hastim, which I believe in Pashtun. It's not Farsi. I believe it's Pashtun. Means we are with you. Obviously, I have this only phonetically, so I hope I'm saying it correctly. But apparently I did, because I got a lot of response. What I wanted to tell these women in that tape, and what I very badly want to make a reality, is that they're not going to be like those pathetic little people in those medieval paintings. The ground will not close over them, that they will not be forgotten, that it will not be as if they never lived. Thank you.
For those of us on the radio listening, we want you to get this number, 888-93-WOMEN. That's 888-93-WOMEN. We need you to get involved. It's going to take a global effort. Thank you, Mavis Leno. She's the chair of the Feminist Majority's Campaign to Stop Gender Apartheid. And now Angela Coffey, a member of the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct today's question and answer.
Thank you, Helen Grieco, State President of the National Organization for Women. Ms. Leno, we have a large number of questions from our audience today, and we're going to try to cover as many of them as we can. There were a number of questions about the Feminist Majority in particular and how you first got involved with both it and this particular subject. So would you like to comment on that, please?
I first got involved with the Feminist Majority 2.5 years ago because I was looking for an organization to work with on feminism that was not a – I'm not a joiner, so I didn't want a large organization. I wanted a small group of people, and I had certain things I particularly wanted to happen in feminism. I really wanted to raise up the next generation of feminists and activists. I really wanted for the gains that women have made here in America in the last 25 years not to be rolled back. And I really wanted to do something for women in other countries who are right at the beginning of the struggle, because I have noticed that every major group that has suffered bigotry and oppression in the world eventually learns that they have to take care of their own. And I felt that American women and women generally in the West were strong enough to take care of their own abroad, to not be so parochial, to not imagine that sisterhood stops at the border. So when I heard about Afghanistan, I realized this is exactly where my heart is. This is exactly what I want to do. And I also thought this is the most extreme situation that I have encountered that women have been subjected to, and it seemed like an urgent issue to draw a line in the sand and say, no, 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 no more. Enough. It's not going to happen anymore. I don't know what we're waiting for until people start killing women in the streets. They have deprived these women of everything that constitutes human life except the literal technical functions of life itself. And as far as I'm concerned, this is where we desperately need to draw the line.
Thank you. How much influence can President Clinton have on bringing about change in Taliban policies? Has Secretary of State Albright taken a position on this? And why hasn't the United Nations taken a stand against the Taliban? And will the recent consideration of President Clinton and nonprofits like Amnesty International expedite global change?
Well, first of all, I'm very happy to say that President Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and Madeleine Albright have all taken extremely firm, extremely public stances against Taliban abuses towards women and their abuses of human rights in general, because they also bury homosexuals alive. They punish thieves by cutting their hands off. These are not, generally speaking, human rights activists. And I am also very happy to say that Kofi Annan has spoken out vehemently against the Taliban and that the UN has continuously drafted stronger legislation against them, including most recently referring to the situation by what I think and the feminist majority thinks is by far the most fitting term, gender apartheid. As far as organizations like Amnesty International, well, what can I say? I revere these people. Their work is superlative, and we stand beside them. We're all trying to contribute, each in our own way. And I believe that the current government is extremely disposed to look favorably upon this, not least because President Clinton is aware and has publicly acknowledged that he is aware that he was elected on the gender gap. I also believe that a lot of conservatives feel very strongly about this. I believe this because really amazingly conservative people like Cal Thomas have come over firmly to our side. So I have optimism regardless of what administration comes in the next couple of years that this is not something that people will overlook.
You've said before that this is an issue without another side, but there has been a great deal of criticism of your efforts recently. In particular, the argument that the Taliban is just the latest celebrity cause in Hollywood. Do you think the benefits of celebrity, namely the media attention that it brings, is outweighed by the fact that the Hollywood political causes aren't taken all that seriously?
Well, I don't know what I can do about that. I'm married to a celebrity. I live in Hollywood. I refuse to be disenfranchised on either of those grounds. I don't see why anybody else who is a celebrity or lives in Hollywood should be disenfranchised on those grounds. And I'm a little bit puzzled as to why people make such a production out of this. You know, almost all the major press in this country belongs to extremely wealthy men. They did not acquire their papers, their magazines, their networks because they were so fantastically knowledgeable about politics and foreign affairs. They got them because they were rich. What is the difference between using your fiscal resources to influence world affairs and using other resources you can bring to the table, such as renown? Many rich people inherited their money. Most famous people earned their fame themselves. There must be something about them that is worth listening to what they have to say.
Touche. What is the source of the Taliban's interpretation of Islam? This questioner says that he or she understands that they were indoctrinated by, or in Pakistan, However, Pakistan does not practice this interpretation. So who sets the rules? Is it one individual or a group?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, because I have looked into this extensively because I'm keenly aware that I am not a Muslim and I am not from the Middle East. And I do not want to act like some big boob going in where I know nothing and trying to dictate my cultural beliefs to other people who don't share them. So I have talked exhaustively to people in the American Afghan community. I have read up on this, and this is my best answer that I can give you at the moment, which is that the Taliban were raised predominantly in extremely conservative Islamic schools where they had many of them are orphans. Many of them were are victims, in fact, tragically, of the Afghan Civil War. And they were given a home in these boys' schools. So an enormous number of these young men have never really had a close female relationship. They don't know their mothers. They don't know their sisters. The things that make even the most conservative countries in the Middle East reckon with certain realities about women as human beings don't figure into the considerations of the Taliban because they haven't known women as human beings. In a sense, their story is very sad. In a sense, they're victims. Not in a sense, in reality. They're victims of the war themselves. It's just sad that they have to perpetuate this victimization. Their version of Islam has never been practiced by any country in the world. It has no support from the rest of the Islam world. It flies in the face of some deeply held Islamic beliefs, particularly denying education to women, because my understanding from all the Afghan people that I have spoken to and also Muslims from other countries, is that this is a very deeply held belief in Islam that everyone is entitled to be educated. Learning is revered in this religion. And the idea that it would be denied to an entire body of the populace really flies in the face of what the rest of the Islamic world believes. It is also the case that the religion, the form of Islam that was followed in Afghanistan for at least the last 40 or 50 years is a very moderate form of Islam. I understand that there are approximately 10 different forms of Islam. For instance, the Shiite would be an extremely conservative form. They followed an extremely liberal form. So what the Taliban are doing is essentially hijacking the true culture and the true religious beliefs of this country and substituting this version of how people should act, which is essentially invented by them. They are not a cult in the sense that they don't follow one charismatic leader, but it does not take a great stretch of the imagination to think what, let's say, California would be like if Jim Jones took it over. It is this kind of, you know, don't question what I say, just do it. Totalitarian thinking that makes them such a nightmare for the people that have to live under their regime.
Mavis, what exactly, in your impression, is the Taliban's motivation to mistreat women in the way they do?
Well, I mean, I've thought about this a lot because I don't believe that people do something for no reason, and I don't think that people are usually evil to themselves. So I don't think that these men have been sitting up nights thinking how to be bad. I think that since they have scarcely had any interaction with women in close relationships in the course of their young lives, they consider women a negligible issue, like cats or dogs. I believe that one of the reasons that at the beginning of the Taliban takeover they were so naked and public about their treatment of women, I think they did this because they had no idea that anybody else thought differently. I think that they were genuinely astounded to find out that the majority of the rest of the world is seriously offended by this. And they are now taking steps to moderate the information that comes out of that country about how they are treating the female half of their population. And I say again, they can't rebuild this country without letting these women back into the world. All they can have is a kind of a bully pulpit where they spend the rest of their lives acting like LA gang members, roaming the streets and hitting people. You know, if that's the kind of government that they think will work, and if that's the kind of life they want to lead, even when they're middle-aged men, even when they're old men, then they should pursue their present course. But obviously, the better part of wisdom would be to repair the infrastructure, bring back the civilian population into the world, including all these women who have an enormous fund of useful skills that their society needs and which they once used to contribute to their society, and make this a happy, functioning country where hopefully America can build a pipeline and bring prosperity to these people without funding all kinds of human rights atrocities in the process. Okay, I'm very sorry. I really don't want anybody taken out. I would be glad to address anything that anybody has to say. I realize that there are people who feel that the stability that a single government has brought to Afghanistan is very valuable. But I am not exaggerating when I say that I have spoken to every Afghan man and woman that I possibly could interact with. And the terrible stories that they tell me have persuaded me that I am not misguided in pursuing this issue. The Taliban edicts were issued by the Taliban. They themselves have said that women cannot wear shoes that make a noise when they walk, that women cannot come out of their houses without wearing the burqa and in the company of a man, that windows must be painted opaque. I did not hear this anecdotally from people. I have the Taliban edicts which state this, and they have not rescinded them. It is entirely possible that they are more liberal with some elements in their population than others, that they are trying to moderate their stance a little bit. I don't know this to be a fact, but I don't know this to be entirely not a fact either. But while these edicts are in force in their country, they are able to visit terrible punishments on anybody they choose who violate these edicts. If they do not choose to punish everybody, that is not the same as giving people back the human rights that they are entitled to and which they enjoyed up until the Taliban takeover.
Mavis, a recent Washington Post article said that efforts by the feminist majority might lead to a decrease in humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. Are these charges true, in your opinion?
This is a very strange thing that has come up recently. I have not only never suggested that humanitarian aid in any way be reduced to Afghanistan, I mean, these people have to live until they see a better day. And in order to do that, they have to eat, they have to clothe their kids and themselves. I would never dream of suggesting that they should not be helped in any way they can possibly be helped by aid groups. And in fact, the very first press conference I ever gave on the subject of the women in Afghanistan, during the course of that, this very issue was addressed, and I said then, I promised an Afghan woman who was representing a Middle Eastern paper that I would never lose sight of the fact that I am not talking just about a block of women. I am talking about one human at a time who has to eat and feed her kids and do the best she can until times get better. And I will never do anything or suggest anything which would make that more difficult for her. But more perplexing is this suggestion that we are promulgating this idea, and it was even suggested in the Washington Post article that some aid has been reduced because of it. Well, you know, I've been on the telephone because I have no agenda except that I want a happy life and a decent world for these people. I have nothing else on my mind but that. And I'm not afraid to talk to anybody and ask them, why did you say this? What would make you, you know, anything I say is what I mean. I have no other motivation. I have no reason to say one thing and do another. And one of the people that I spoke to said that she was seriously misquoted and is consulting a lawyer. And the other people that suggested this were Save the Children. And I have in my possession, in fact, they have it in my bag right now, a letter that was sent to me at the end of December of this past year from the president of Save the Children, congratulating my husband and I on the wonderful work we're doing for the rights of the women and girls of Afghanistan. So this person who has suggested that we are, in fact, hampering the efforts of Save the Children is apparently not on the same page as his boss. I also have asked everybody I called to cite me a single instance of any human rights group suggesting that aid be reduced to this country, and a single instance where it actually has in any way been harmed, and no one can tell me one single organization that has advocated this or one single instance where money was reduced. And I am a singularly unparanoid person. But I have to say that this particular issue does strike me as genuine disinformation. The fact is that the Taliban threw all the aid organizations out of their country in August of 1998, and most of them are trying desperately to negotiate their way back in to help these people, which is certainly to the good. But the only problem that I am familiar with at all and that anybody else can name to me with getting aid to the people in Afghanistan is the Taliban themselves. For one thing, they refuse to distribute aid equally amongst men and women, which is a serious issue with a number of aid organizations. And for another thing, most of the aid workers for these organizations are women, and their life within Afghanistan, trying to distribute food and clothes to these people is a nightmare. They are perpetually harassed. They are in fear of their lives. I agree, a lot of aid that could go to all the desperate people in that country is not getting there, but neither my organization, nor myself, nor any human rights organization that I was able to track down anywhere in the world is preventing it. It is the Taliban themselves that are making it difficult for this aid to get to their people.
Thank you. The Taliban restrictions sound like they would place a heavy burden upon families. What has been the response of Afghan men to the Taliban efforts?
Most Afghan men are crushed under an unbearable load. Where they once had two salary families, or at least the working efforts of their wives, if they're farmers, their wives worked alongside of them. They had a small business, their wife helped out. And they generally, traditionally, have large families. And now they find themselves the sole support of a wife that cannot even go out of the house without their accompaniment. You can imagine what an incredible burden this is. Every single thing that has to be done in the course of a day to maintain an average family, the man has to do, as well as earn a living for perhaps a family of 3, 4, 5 kids, himself and his wife. It's a nightmare. And they are expected to attend prayers, I believe 6 times a day. I'm not absolutely sure of that figure, but 5 or 6 times a day. And they are not allowed to shave their beards. And they are also subject, in other words, to a lot of restrictions and harassment, and a lot of the loss of the female half of the population has fallen upon their shoulders. And again, like decent men anywhere, they have to look at the future of their daughters in despair. People have hopes for their children, and when they feel that there is no chance that those hopes will ever bear fruit, they suffer. So I think it's absolutely the case that these men suffer very badly under this regime.
Unfortunately, we have time for just one last question, and this questioner asks, I hope you are writing a book. If so, when will it be at my bookstore?
Well, I'm writing a book, but it's a mystery. I'm not. That's what I do. I'm a writer. But I haven't written anything about this because I don't know how it turns out. And all I can say to you tonight is, to all of you here, to anybody that hears this on the radio, you know, if I am going to write about this someday, please help me give a happy ending. Thank you.
Our thanks to Mavis Leno, chair of the Feminist Majority's Campaign to Stop Gender Apartheid, for joining us today. Mavis, it's people like you who make the world a better place. Special thanks to our audience here at the Commonwealth Club, as well as those listening on the radio today. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and World Affairs Council of Northern California is adjourned.